Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Episode 10, everybody. That's right. This is episode 10 of the Nerd Party, and we're going to have a fantastic podcast for you tonight because we are going to revisit a special franchise to both Matt and I, and that is the X-Men film franchise, specifically the original trilogy. But before we get into that, Matt, there was just maybe some minor little news that happened with Marvel last week.
Well, in case you've also been living under a rock and happened to miss also the Age of Ultron trailer from 2 weeks ago, Marvel really spoiled us with it the last week, especially if you're, like me, a hardcore fan of the cinematic universe, because on last Tuesday, we even mentioned, I think it was last show, I mentioned that there was going to be some press event happening on the previous Tuesday. We didn't know what it was for. You and I were speculating what it might be for, and it turned out it was to unveil the Phase 3 lineup for the next, it's going into 2019, so the next 5 years of Marvel movies.
Next 5 years is pretty insane. So, like, here's the list. In 2016, we have Captain America, Civil War. We have Doctor Strange. And going into 2017, we have Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Thor Ragnarok, Black Panther. And in 2018, we have Avengers Infinity War Part 1. That's right, you heard me correctly. And continuing in 2018 is Captain Marvel, as well as Inhumans. And finishing up with 2019, Avengers Infinity War Part 2.
And would it be fair to say, Tristan, that the internet made a little bit of noise when this was announced on Tuesday? Just a tiny bit of noise?
This was pretty insane. Like, I was at work when it happened, and I completely forgot about the Marvel announcement, and the internet exploded. I was seeing GIF sets left and right. And also, the first thing we saw was Captain America's... what was it?
Like Serpent Society.
Serpent Society, that's right. And like people were like, what's going on there? And then there was this backlash where how do you pronounce his last name?
Kevin Feige,
thank you. Kevin Feige, he said, he's like, I'm just kidding, it's Civil War. And everybody's like, Kevin. But then like there was this backlash on the internet where people are like, no, I'm pissed, I liked Serpent Society.
There wasn't that much of a backlash. I mean,
there really was. I saw it like crazy on the day. Like
must,
so many people.
You must be following a bunch of DC people then, because like the people that I followed with the Marvel stuff, like once Civil War was actually announced as the real title, that's when things started to get really interesting and in a positive way.
Yeah, well, we all knew it was going to happen, and when I saw Serpent Society, I was like, okay, well, they're going to have to change something about that, or it's going to end with Civil War or something.
See, but this is what I like about Marvel, and people, you know, I've gotten into, you know, discussions, heated discussions with people over Twitter over the last week regarding this lineup, but I have nothing against DC. I mean, they haven't made movies that I particularly love the way that I do Marvel movies, but I will say... You know, people were like, oh, why didn't the internet make a big deal when DC made their lineup? And here's the thing. Regardless of what you think of the Marvel movies, I think it's absolutely fair to say that Marvel absolutely brings the showmanship and hype machine more so than DC does. Now, does that equal quality? Not necessarily. But when you're in this movie business, you have to know how to market yourself. And Marvel really pulls out all the stops. They make it this huge event. I mean, they brought in... Downey and Evans to introduce Civil War and the new Black Panther casting. So they know what they're doing as far as putting on a show, and that's really important to their success.
And the thing is that they know their audience. I mean, like Marvel has such a huge presence at Comic-Con and other conventions, and they have a really good online presence with social media and everything like that. And they just, I mean, it all started with Iron Man. It's just like, you know, the producers had a vision and like, we want to create this cinematic universe. And with DC, they were still riding high on the Dark Knight trilogy. And so, you know, they didn't really have the opportunity to create the same kind of universe, or at least they didn't have that opportunity that they made for themselves. And so, you know, they're just ahead of the game when it comes to a cohesive vision. Now, does it mean that it's better or worse? It depends on who you ask. But I mean, Marvel. You're absolutely right. The Marvel has showmanship. And just for a comparison of the 5-year plan, which actually DC has a 6-year plan. This is the DC lineup. We have Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice for 2016. Also coming out in 2016 is Suicide Squad. And then continuing on into 17, we have two films: Wonder Woman and Justice League Part 1. And then with, in 2018, The Flash, as well as Aquaman. And then 19 has Shazam and Justice League Part 2, and Cyborg in 2020, and Green Lantern as well in 2020.
And it's not that I'm not excited about DC's lineup, but I had this discussion with you earlier, and I said something, I made a comment to the effect of, I'm more excited for Marvel, not only as a Marvel fan, but I know for sure that all of Marvel's will get made. And I know that sounds kind of snarky, but the intention behind it is that, you know, Marvel's had 6 years worth of a track record, and they've taken little known properties and made them big. Now, DC had, if we're talking, you know, non-Dark Knight, because that's not going to be connected to this universe. They're rebooting Batman.
That's right.
So if we're just talking DC, they have one movie that was very, very divisive among audiences. It wasn't, whatever you think of Man of Steel, it wasn't critically or universally embraced to the extent that first Iron Man was. Would you agree?
Oh, I would completely agree, absolutely. And I think the charisma of Downey, it definitely helped that. And the thing is, like, think about, like, Iron Man came out. Oh crap! When did Iron Man come out?
May of 2008.
Jeez, you had that on the nose. Okay, you didn't even stop to think about that. So, like, you know, Iron Man came out in 2008, and then Man of Steel just came out last year.
Last year, yeah. Last summer, yeah.
So, I mean, Marvel's had those years, like, and Man of Steel was the beginning of the DC cinematic universe. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like the beginning of their new created world that's going to be all interconnected. DC's never had that, and so, like, Marvel had a way huge of a head start on DC when it came to this type of filmmaking.
They did. I'm just saying that if we compare first entries into a series that's supposed to spin off everything, Man of Steel wasn't received nearly as well as that first Iron Man, or at least not as universally well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Iron Man was a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes, and Man of Steel was 50-something. That is a monumental difference between an opening movie for a cinematic universe.
And I realize critics aren't everything, but I believe the audience reaction scores, if we judge it off of Rotten Tomatoes, it was higher for Iron Man versus Man of Steel as well.
Yeah, and I'm a big DC fan, and I was the same way with Man of Steel. Like, I like certain parts of it, but overall, I was split down the middle. I was like, eh.
So I'm just saying, you know, as far as Marvel versus DC's lineup, imagine that they were both, you know, handing in resumes as part of a job, you know what I mean? And Marvel has this track record where, whether or not you think of the quality, they've been sort of consistent, they've been embraced by audiences, they have enough cachet where, say, something like next year's Ant-Man doesn't perform as well as they thought that they would.
Yeah.
If that happens, Marvel's not in trouble. They can afford to have a movie miss. Whereas I feel like with DC, they're really betting the house on this Batman versus Superman movie. If it doesn't perform to their expectations, that slate is in trouble. Whereas with Marvel, if Ant-Man doesn't do well, we're still going to get, what's the next one? We're still going to get Civil War, obviously.
Right. Yeah, we're still going to get Civil War. And I think that'll appease a lot of people. It's just so funny when you compare the two lists. And I'm excited for both. But the thing is that even amongst, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but even amongst comic book fans and Marvel fans, whether you're Marvel or DC fans, you have stuff like Black Panther and Captain Marvel and Inhumans. These are, you know, these are smaller properties, a lot like Guardians of the Galaxy was. But then when you have DC, you have The Flash, Aquaman, Shazam, Cyborg, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Suicide Squad. These are big properties. Maybe not Suicide Squad, but these are big properties that they're banking on. And it's still the same amount. I don't even know exactly what I'm trying to say. Like, Marvel can take small properties and get the same amount of excitement, if not more, from DC's large properties right now because of that cachet that they earned over the past 6 years.
And to that point, news came out this week that Guardians of the Galaxy has become worldwide the second highest grossing movie of 2014. Just passing, I think, $760 million. It's on its way to $800 million. Who the hell would have thought that when that property was announced, 2 years ago?
And that's so true, because when they announced it, everybody except for like a small audience was like, "What? Who? What is this?
A talking raccoon cares? In a tree?"
Yeah, I am excited though. I am excited that we're getting that Wonder Woman is coming out before Captain Marvel. I am excited that that DC is going to be the pioneer on the female led superhero movie.
Well, in the modern age, of course.
Of the modern age, because of course we've had previous ones, but you know what I'm saying.
Yes, I know what you're saying. Just as I'm proud that Marvel's going to beat DC as far as if African American lead superhero goes.
It's true, because we don't get Cyborg until 2020.
But big news, they also announced that 42-star Chadwick Boseman is going to be Black Panther, and had them on stage with Chris Evans and Robert Downey Jr. And it answers a question that we had last week, Tristan, about what they could possibly do with Civil War, given the fact that A, there's no superhero identities, and B, that there's no Spider-Man in this universe. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? I think it's being implied that Black Panther is going to take over the Spider-Man role.
I think that was implied as well. And yeah, I think that's some great casting. Even though I didn't like the movie 42, his performance was really good. And also we got Jason Momoa for Aquaman, which is such a badass casting choice. Like, if you have to have an Aquaman movie, which I don't think you do, that is such a perfect casting choice, because Jason Momoa is a badass, and from what I've seen of Game of Thrones, I saw season one because I didn't like it, which when I saw him come on screen, he had very little to say and very little to do. When he first came on screen, you're just like, okay, they just got him for his looks and he's just going to be a thug with no brain. The dude can act. Really? And he can act well, yeah.
Because the only thing I'm familiar with him is that really bad Conan remake.
Yeah, no, don't judge him by that. No, he's actually a good actor, and he looks badass, and he's Hawaiian. So it's fantastic. It just works. And so I'm actually genuinely excited for an Aquaman movie, which I never thought I'd ever hear myself say.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that there is some enthusiasm among the DC fans. I'm sure that there is among that fan base as well. I'm not trying to discount anything.
You're totally trying to be condescending right
now.
No,
I'm not. I'm really, honestly, I'm not. I think people are allowed to like whatever they want to like. I just happen to have a little bit more faith in the Marvel lineup.
All right. Well, one thing that I don't have faith in this lineup that I just read about today in the Marvel Universe is that Thor 3, as well as Avengers Infinity War, is going to be heavily featuring Loki. Give me a break. Enough with the Loki.
I don't think you can say that, Tristan, only because A, he's a fan favorite, and B, if Avengers Infinity War, well, first of all, he's got to be in Thor, because
why?
If you've seen the end of Thor: The Dark World, he has to be in Thor 3.
Yeah, and there was no reason for Thor 2 to end that way.
Well, but it did. So, we gotta work with what we have.
I'm so tired of Loki. There's so many other cool villains in the Marvel universe out there.
You really are the only one out there, because we love Tom Hiddleston. We love this character. And as far as Avengers Infinity War goes, I mean, he's the one who started this whole Infinity Gauntlet story with that first movie, because the staff... it's being implied that his staff that he had is an Infinity Stone. Mm-hmm. The objects in both Thor 2 and in Guardians of the Galaxy are both Infinity Stones. I like seeing how they're going to weave this in, and I honestly think that despite rumblings of a Phase 4 happening, Phase 3 is really going to be the conclusion to the MCU that we know it to be now. If they do come back for Phase 4, I think it's going to be way different. But I predict that Avengers 3 Part 2 will close this first era, if you will, of the MCU. So if that's the case, then I want some closure for some of these characters, and for me that includes Loki. So
all right.
I'm not, you know, I have more reservations about them shoving all the Justice League members into this next movie, but
well, the thing is though, is that I think it's kind of that same situation with even though this isn't a good example because it was a crap movie, Amazing Spider-Man 2 had, like, when we were seeing the trailers, everybody's like, this is going to be horrible. There's going to be too many bad people in it. There's too many villains. Yeah, how can you focus on, you know, this many people? Well, some of those people were only in it for like one scene or two. And we now know that in Batman versus Superman, Wonder Woman is only in it for a very limited amount of time.
She's been filming a long time for someone who's barely in it.
I read that she was just in a few scenes. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm just, you know, the reason I'm more hesitant with that is because, and maybe I'm just thinking about it the wrong way, but with the Marvel movies, I liked how everybody kind of got a movie, so I knew who they were. As someone who's not a comic book reader, all the Avengers having their own movie first let me know kind of who they were, kind of the backstory, and gave me a reason to actually care about them beyond the fact that they're the good guys, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be really hard to, you know, you still haven't really established Superman. You're going to have to introduce Batman. Wonder Woman's going to have to be in there somewhere. You have to build up Lex Luthor. You have to, you know, there's so many things that this movie has to do that, you know, maybe I just don't think that way. But I don't know how you do that in like a 2 or 2 to 2.5 hour film.
Well, the thing is that we have to remember is that DC is not Marvel and it's not trying to be. And so that's the beauty of it, I think, in my mind, is that they don't have to follow a pattern. They don't have to follow the Marvel pattern of having Iron Man, having Captain America, having Thor.
That being said, though, they are trying to follow a Marvel pattern in a way, because they weren't even thinking about a cinematic universe until the Avengers made $1.5 billion.
I wouldn't say that they weren't thinking about it. I think a lot of people were saying this needs to happen, and they were waiting for Nolan to finish.
But still, I mean, like, I think that they are borrowing stuff from whether DC fans like to admit it or not. Marvel was the trailblazer for this kind of comic book storytelling. So,
well, it's kind of like saying the Rolling Stones owes everything to the Beatles. I mean, you know, it's like it's two great entities that make great music that sound very different, but you know, the Beatles were there first.
I think you're being very generous, but.
Well, let's talk about another Marvel property, maybe something that we can agree on, and let's talk about the X-Men film franchise. The first one came out in 2000, which was a long time ago, if you think about it. It was 14 years, almost 15 years ago.
And yet, I do remember seeing it in theaters.
I didn't see this one in theater. For some reason, I was not that stoked about it. I don't know why. I mean, this, you know...
I'll tell you why. Think about it.
Why?
Because you have to think about where we were in 2000, right? As far as comic book movies are concerned. So the 70s and early 80s were all dominated with Superman. And then after he went off the rails with Part 4, then it was all Batman for the 80s and 90s. And then that franchise kind of derailed after Batman and Robin. So that was 97. So for sort of the 3 years in between, superhero films were kind of in limbo because they were seen as very, very corny and very... jokey and way too camp for their own good, I would say. And Marvel hadn't really made a tentpole movie before. I mean, they had tried in the 80s and 90s to get things off the ground, and nothing successful came to fruition. Finally, in 1998, that's when the first Blade movie came out, but that was sort of a niche. It would put them on the map, but it was sort of a niche film that kind of grew with time. So really, people credit, I guess, what we call this modern era of superhero films. A lot of people credit that first Spider-Man movie in 2002 for kind of exploding Marvel onto the map. But really, it's X-Men that put them on the map, because once this film came out, superheroes kind of became a thing again, because this first one was successful.
Yeah, it was successful. I don't know if it I've kind of heard the opposite. I don't know if people... I think people give the first X-Men the credit to the 2000s, because like you said, we had Blade, which was more niche, and before that we had Spawn, and that was just an epic failure. And yeah, it wasn't until 2000 and onward where we had the X-Men film franchise. And like, think about it, in the 2000s, like, listen to this list, because because like you said, in the 90s, you know, we had The Shadow, Batman Forever, Mystery Men, Steel, you know, Fantastic Four. None of these were really, like the Fantastic Four one was the
Roger Corman one
that wasn't released. Yeah. And so like all of these just weren't very good, like you were talking about. But once 2000 hit, you had X-Men, you had Unbreakable, you had Hellboy, Punisher, the good Fantastic Four, Fantastic Mr. Four. You had Watchmen, Batman Begins, you had The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man, Spider-Man 2, Blade Trinity. Yeah, like you had all in the rest of the X-Men films, you had all of these just like dropping like crazy in the 2000s. And yeah, X-Men was definitely the tip of the spear for that.
Well, I agree with that. I kind of, you know, my at least perception at the time, because this was around the time where I was old enough to like be aware of stuff around me and kind of the rumblings of the movie industry. Mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that X-Men, when it came out, it was a hit. I think people were kind of surprised and taken aback. The attitude that I kind of felt, especially when that first Spider-Man was coming out in 2002, was maybe X-Men was just kind of a fluke, and maybe, you know, it's one film. Let's see what happens. And I think after that first Spider-Man was so successful, that's when I started, you know, it became a lot more prevalent, because that following year, 2003, you get both like Daredevil and Hulk, and you start getting in that second X-Men. So, you know, they started becoming more released each year. You know, for the next, really, every year after 2002, you have at least one comic book film coming out. So it wasn't that way with the first X-Men. You know, there's two good years in between that first X-Men and the first Spider-Man.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny when you think about it, because they, you know, like nowadays, when you have a movie that's going to be the beginning of a franchise or the beginning of a tentpole, as you said, usually they try to get a heavy hitter director or producer, or if they have a director that doesn't have that many credits to his or her name, they get a high level producer or something like that. But with this one, they got Bryan Singer, which at that time, barely anybody knew, and the only reason
he wasn't nobody, he had Usual Suspects under his belt.
That's what I was gonna say, is that like he didn't say he was anybody, he was a nobody. I said like people barely knew him, and all he had really was the usual Suspects. Before that, Public Access and Lion's Den. Have you seen Public Access or Lion's Den?
No, I haven't, but I've also seen it's a little known movie called Apt Pupil that he directed with Ian McKellen. Yes. That's the first time he works with Ian McKellen. And that's a pretty good mm-hmm. film. It's based off a Stephen King story, which I like. It's not perfect, but I do enjoy it. And Usual Suspects is a good film. So
yeah, Usual Suspects has become a classic, and it's a good film. But the thing is, you know, like he had, you know, one or two really good films, but none of these are anything like a superhero film or like X-Men or sci-fi or anything like that. And it's just, I'm glad that they took a chance, because it paid off.
You know, he was never handed the keys to a franchise before.
Exactly. Yeah. And with this one, it like I said, it paid off, and but they didn't get him for a trilogy deal.
Well, there's a storied history behind that, which I'm sure we'll get into when we talk about X3. Mm. But this first X-Men, I mean, a lot was riding on this to be successful, because like I said, comic book movies by 2000 are kind of a tainted genre, if you will, especially with Batman and Robin and Steel coming out. I think they were, if not the same year, they were within a year of each other. So, you know, this first of all, you have to get the right person at the helm, and then you also have to cast it right. That was the big thing for X-Men that I remember. Is that they, you know, you had to cast it right. And in particular, you needed to make sure that your two major leads, which are Charles Xavier and Magneto, are casted with actors that not only can play the parts, but bring a certain amount of respect and gravitas to the role, because they're, especially in this first movie, they're the ones that have most of the exposition, and they're the ones that are gonna have to sell you on the believability of this world. And so mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, quite fortunate luck that they got two massively good actors in both Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen.
Yeah, you cannot get better, and I mean that literally. you cannot get better than Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen together. And what's one really funny thing is, like, and if you've listened to pretty much any Nerd Party episode before this one, you'll know that both Matt and I are big James Cameron films, and James Cameron was originally attached to this film as a producer, with Kathryn Bigelow being the director. And since you're talking about casting, Bob Hoskins was considered for Wolverine, and Angela Bassett was considered for Storm.
Angela Bassett,
very different movie.
Yes, it would have. Angela Bassett, I could see.
Oh, very much so. Angela Bassett is. I could see her as Storm more than I see Halle Berry.
Yeah.
But Bob Hoskins, really?
No.
Really, folks?
No. Instead, what happened is we got... He had to have been unknown at the time, or at least if he had been in anything, I don't remember seeing him before then, because this is the role that made him one, you know, very, very special export from Australia in the form of Mr. Hugh Jackman.
This was definitely his first major film, because he had some, I'm looking at his early work right now, and it might have been in Australia, might have been here, I'm not quite sure, but it's absolutely nothing that I recognize except for The Man from Snowy River, which was on television. And he was in the stage play Oklahoma, which was actually quite successful, and was actually a pretty good DVD sales, but then in 99 they casted him for X-Men, and then the rest is history. And he's been Wolverine 7 times since then.
And having watched that first film again, you know, the moment that you get to see him, he's in the cage match, he's smoking a cigar. I never read X-Men comics, but growing up in the 90s, my dad used to watch that the 90s X-Men cartoon that I'm sure most 90s children grew up with. So, I knew who Wolverine was. And just seeing Hugh Jackman do that first scene, they couldn't have gotten anybody better. They really couldn't have.
And what an intro for a character. I mean, because you establish so much in that first scene, and then the scene that follows it, you establish so much about his character, where he comes from and how he thinks and how he feels. And it's just, it was really good filmmaking. And with Halle Berry as Storm, I just never really connected with her as Halle, like, especially in this first film, because she tries to do an African accent.
Yeah, that was not so good.
She tries in some scenes and then just drops it altogether in other scenes. So, and then in X2 and X3, she's just completely American.
She talks like Halle Berry.
She's Halle Berry. So essentially, Halle Berry plays Halle Berry in these movies. But one person who I thought was perfect besides Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, and that's Famke Janssen.
Oh, I was so excited to see her, because you and I are both Star Trek fans, so obviously we know her from mm-hmm. the episode of Next Gen that she did, but forever and always, and I love her as Jean Grey, but forever and always, she's Xenia on a top to me from GoldenEye.
that's seriously, like, you. Those are the two main things that I know her from, and know her from still, is the I almost called her the Xenomorph from Star Trek. That's not right. The Asimorph?
She was a Metamorph.
Metamorph? Okay, yeah. Metamorph from Star Trek, who falls in love with Patrick Stewart. So she reunites with Patrick Stewart in this movie. And, Xenia Onatopp. Onatopp? Onatopp.
Onatopp, with her killer thighs.
Her literally killer thighs. And I always loved Jean Grey in the comic books and the cartoon, and she was perfect casting choice. And one person who I was excited to see as Cyclops, because... I know I get made fun of a lot, or at least I do, or at least I did in the geek community, for having Cyclops be my favorite character. He's my absolute favorite X-Men, and everybody thought I was stupid because Cyclops, they thought it was a lame superpower, and that he was kind of a jerk in the comics, which he is. But I felt like James Marsden was kind of wasted, and the character was wasted in these movies.
Yeah, I feel kind of bad for James Marsden, because it's not that he doesn't play the role right. I think he does. It's just they don't give him much to do. What he does well.
Right.
But I'm kind of excited because there are rumors that we're going to see the younger versions of Cyclops and Jean and Storm in the next movie, Apocalypse, in 2016. So maybe I think they're finally going to get to do the character some justice, because... The thing that I'll say about these movies, I love especially the first two, but you can tell when you're watching these early ones, it was a very, very different way of comic book movie making back then, because not only had something like this not really been attempted before, because you had tentpole superheroes like Superman was a one-man show, and so was Batman. Even with Robin, was sort of a one-man show. This is the first time you're trying out an ensemble, and this is the first time you're kind of working in this new post-millennial way of telling a superhero story. And you know, I watched the first one especially. I mean, I still like it, but it's very, very, like, it's almost like a proto-superhero movie of what we know today. You know, we've been spoiled post, Spider-Man, and really post-MCU starting and post-Nolan, that, you know, mm-hmm. we now have a handle on what superhero movies are, but here they're still kind of feeling out everything.
I think you're right. I think that's a really good way of putting it. It's a proto-superhero film. I like that. I'm going to steal that. I think you're absolutely right, because they don't know how to work the ensemble. They don't know exactly how much to focus on the powers and how much not to, how much story do they need and how much action. And I think they pulled it off, but you can feel that they're still testing the waters. And one thing, like, besides even Cyclops, who I'm glad that you agree that they kind of wasted him, was one thing that I was kind of surprised. And maybe this was a symptom of them testing the waters, is Rogue, played by Anna Paquin. I like Anna Paquin. I've liked a lot of her movies. I thought she did pretty well in True Blood. But the Rogue character was neutered in comparison to what she was in the comic books.
And I never really encountered this problem because, like I said, maybe this is my advantage of not reading comic books, is that the only kind of Rogue that I know is Anna Paquin's Rogue. So I have no basis for comparison, but I did hear that as well.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Rogue was such a badass character. You did not mess with Rogue, but the thing is, she had the "I can't touch you, I'm very tortured, you know, like I don't know my family, I was abandoned by my family." And we actually find out in certain iterations, depends on what you're watching or what you're reading, that Mystique is actually Rogue's mom.
I've heard that too. I mean, I went back and did some research of the actual comic history, I'm like, wow, this is way more connected than I ever would have imagined.
Yeah, this was before the film Days of Future Past, where everybody knows everybody and everybody's friends.
We'll get to Days of Future Past later, but as far as standouts in this first movie is concerned, we just mentioned her. Aside from Ian McKellen's magnificent role as Magneto and him embodying that sort of, we'll talk about Magneto in a minute, but the other standout that I remember clearly from this movie is Rebecca Romijn as Mystique.
Yeah, they publicized her character hard, and I was really surprised at how much emphasis she was given in the first film, especially considering she doesn't have that much to say, but she has a lot to do. And Rebecca Romijn was literally naked while filming.
I'm sure that's why you cast Rebecca Romijn. I mean, she was here's the thing I like about Rebecca Romijn, though. She doesn't say that much in this first film, at least. I argue she gets more in the second. But the thing that I like about her is, even though she's a model that can act, because I never not believe her as Mystique, even when she's delivering lines. Like, I love her first when she's in the plane with Bruce Davison as the really asshole senator who wants to enact this mutant registration act, and her first line is, it was people like you that were the reason I was afraid to go to school as a child. Even that, I bought her instantly as this character.
And then she holds his face with her left foot and then smacks him around with her right foot. That's just cool.
No, she was a badass, and they really, you know, if nothing else, they really sold Mystique on me, and really, she's continued to be one of the best characters in the film series, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, and I was I always forget how much of a major role she plays when I go back and rewatch the films. And this one ends pretty well, pretty epically, where they have the, you know, like Magneto wants to change everybody into a mutant, and he uses the Statue of Liberty, and they're all perched on the Statue of Liberty, and you know, Wolverine has to, like, Rogue has to steal Wolverine's powers in order to heal herself, and there, it's just like really epic stuff, you know, like all on Liberty Island and everything like that. And so it ends very well, and it also ends on a teaser note where we see that Rebecca Romijn as Mystique has taken over Senator Kelly's form. and has infiltrated the government. And then so we obviously need an X2.
Yes, obviously. The one thing I... two more points I just want to make real quickly before we move on to X2. One, I do remember that this was the first superhero movie I saw, and I'm a Star Trek fan, as we've established, and I kind of like seeing the sort of cultural metaphors and stories that they try to tell in Star Trek. And X-Men was actually the first movie in the first film series where I kind of noticed, huh, superhero movies can actually be used as a commentary as well. And I always kind of wondered why I was so drawn to superhero movies before, like never before. And I kind of, with X-Men, it kind of helped me realize superhero movies are just another kind of science fiction when you think about it. I mean, it was the first time that you know, metaphors were being used. I think it also helps the fact that the director of these two films, Bryan Singer, is gay. So you get, especially in this first film, you know, a lot of a fear of mutants and this fear of change and this mutant registration act, it could be seen as that kind of metaphor. It could be seen as a metaphor for any group of people that has been classified as different and ostracized by society. So mm-hmm. I really appreciated that about at least these first two films. And even in X3 has its own problems, but they, you know, when we get to that film, I will argue that its intentions were good, but it fell apart in the interim. But let's talk about X2 though.
Let's talk about X2. Like X2, I feel like a lot of people like this one more, and I feel like a lot of people like X2 more than the first one, and I can't really put my finger on it, on why people like this one more, and I feel like maybe it's because they got to know the characters a little bit better, they got to know the style that everyone was going for, you got a few more characters, you get some of the younger characters to kind of that have a little bit more prominent role, where the students are no longer just background and extra characters. Mm-hmm. They're actually people integral to the plot. And you have some people crossing sides, and you have that awesome prison break sequence in the plastic prison.
It's kind of great because, like you said, yeah, you're getting introduced to more of the school, at least Rogue and... In this one, it's Rogue, Iceman, and Pyro that get more of the spotlight as far as the younger students go. Mm-hmm. I think what I like about it more, I am one of those people that does like X2 better than X1, even though I like them both very much. But the thing that I remember liking about X2, especially when I saw it in the theater, because I did go to the theater again for this one, is that once the origin story is out of the way, now we can focus on like a really cool story. Not that the origin story is not cool, but they're kind of like the obligatory thing that you have to do for your first film. So now that that's out of the way, let's actually delve into something deeper. Let's see these characters use their powers some more. I mean, I remember just having so much fun with the school break-in scene in the middle of the film. That was just a blast. And we, you know, back then, like I said, superhero movies were kind of a new thing. So we'd never seen kind of like that mayhem before. And it was really cool to see them work as an ensemble.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, like this movie made more money, and it did better in the box office, which it breaks that whole sequel mode of being an inferior product than the first one. I think it pushed the limit just a little bit more in every single thing. And it was just overall fun, I think. And it just had a lot of great elements to it that made it interesting. And we got the introduction of Nightcrawler, played by Alan Cumming, which I think was a great storyline, because that scene where that assassination attempt on the president, it really kind of hit home. Like in the first one, it's all about what could mutants do to us, what's the potential of what they could do to us, and all that we really saw was just some random senator that we didn't care about, and that was all that we saw, the effect of what humans could, like what mutants could do to humans. But in the second one, we made it personal. It was an assassination attempt on the president. That, and they did it in an epic and cool way. And this one really kind of tipped the scale towards our consciousness, or how we thought about this movie, where, okay, this is a real issue for this world, for the world that we're peeping into. And this is, so like, if that actually happened today, if there was a group of people or a representative of a group of people actually made it that far into the White House, we would take it very personally. And so I feel like there was this juxtaposition, or this, how we were just able to relate to a little bit more. And so the stakes were raised.
And let's not forget that first X-Men was in 2000. X2 is the first X-Men film coming out after the post 9/11 world, if you will. So it made this,
I didn't even think about that.
this made this sort of attack on the White House seem much more personal and much more, you know, of the time. And it worked really well. That scene that you're talking about with Nightcrawler at the beginning, I would say until Days of Future Past, there was never a more cool example of use of mutant powers in any of those films than that opening scene of X2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. Like, and when we talk about Days of Future Past, we'll have an entire episode devoted to Days of Future Past. And yeah, that has to be one of the coolest superhero intros, not just in the X-Men franchise, but in a superhero movie.
Right. So, and also, you know, lest we forget, X2 ends with, shall we say, a very Wrath of Khan moment, to use another Star Trek metaphor, the sacrifice of Jean Grey.
That's right, the sacrifice of Jean Grey. So the whole movie culminates to them trying to get away in the jet, and it can't lift off because of reasons, but the dam broke down and all the water's rushing, and so Jean walks down into the rushing water, stops it with her mind, and lifts the jet off, and actually talks through Patrick Stewart in order to say goodbye to Cyclops, which I really liked this moment. I liked the sacrifice, I liked the idea of the sacrifice, and even though I feel like she could have done that from within the plane, but whatever. I like the moment because they play it honest. The actors play it honest, where Patrick Stewart recites the lines as Jean, and he does it with just a little bit of femininity, but doesn't overdo it to make it comical. And Cyclops, played by James Marsden, is reacting to Patrick Stewart as if he's Jean Grey, as if he's Famke Janssen, and it's believable, and it works, and it's real, and it's emotional.
Oh yeah, you have James Marsden getting emotional, you have Hugh Jackman really getting emotional. That's the first time we see Hugh Jackman in the series actually being affected by someone personally, because they've been building up this sort of love connection between him and Jean, along with, mm-hmm. you know, the already established love connection between Jean and Scott. And really, if I think about it, and think back to the superhero films before this, Tristan, you know, your major tentpoles of Superman and Batman, I really think that this is the first time a superhero movie ended with one of the heroes dying, quote unquote.
Well, by staying dead, I think so. I mean,
when I think about, I'm talking about that, the, you know, those, the major ones, like the first four Supermans and the first four Batmans, they didn't end with anybody heroic dying.
Well, I mean, we had Lois Lane who died, but only for like a couple of minutes.
Oh, right.
Before he reversed time by going backwards in space. Yeah, like, I don't think anybody died in the Spider-Man films.
Not the ones at the time. That no one died in that, you know, other than Uncle Ben in that first one, which was the only right, one at the time.
And that was at the beginning. And so, yeah, I think you might be right. I mean, it's
And I just remember it because I was in 2003. That would have made me 14 or 15. I can't put my 14. It would have made me 14. And I just remember that thinking in the theater, wow, they actually killed a superhero, because like that just didn't happen in these Hollywood movies.
And see, what's funny is that everybody who actually read the comic books knew that she wasn't dead. I know that. And that's the cool thing about it, is that if you didn't, you can just appreciate it for what it was meant to be. And then bam, she's actually dead. Gee, I wonder what that that flying thing was underneath the water.
I turned to my dad after that was done. What was that thing under the water? And he says, oh, she's going to come back as the Phoenix. And I'm like, well, what's the Phoenix? And well, 3 years later, I found out what the Phoenix was, at least in this movie universe.
And when I saw that, I was one of those people who just slammed his fist down and was like, yeah, that's going to be awesome. X3 is going to be awesome.
Oh, man. And,
well, it kind of wasn't. So let's talk about X3, the X-Men, The Last Stand. Now, before we get into it, we need to talk about a little bit about the behind the scenes, where this one is not directed by Bryan Singer. This one's directed by Brett Ratner. Well, and the thing is, Bryan Singer left so that he could start another, what he thought was going to be franchise or trilogy, and that's Superman. He went off to direct Superman Returns, which was an epic failure. And he took James Marsden with him.
Yeah, he did.
He stole Cyclops.
He did. Although I do remember liking Superman Returns more at the time than X3 The Last Stand, but that's a discussion for another time. But main point being is that this one had a very troubled history, because for a number of different reasons. A, you have Bryan Singer eventually leaving. He started production and then he left.
Mm-hmm.
B, you also having to, it was, I think it was known at the time that the actors were initially signed on for two films, because back then there wasn't this Marvel Cinematic Universe practice of booking all these actors for 17 films.
Well, okay, but okay. But there was a standard practice at the time for a trilogy deal, which was not started by Marvel, so don't even imagine.
No, I'm not saying it started by Marvel. What I'm saying is that you know, they didn't even think about this at the time, because they only booked these actors for two movies. So with this third one, they're having to renegotiate everybody. And
yes,
that's ultimately why Halle Berry gets more screen time in this third one, if you noticed. Because, you know, she got all highfalutin after she won that Oscar. That's why you get she got more screen time in this one. But so there's that. And then they went through a number of different directors. At one time, what I find really interesting is that Matthew Vaughn, who eventually went on to direct X-Men First Class, was attached to direct this film. And he couldn't meet Fox's production schedule. They wanted this thing out. It had already been decided. They wanted this thing out summer 2006. Beginning of summer 2006. Yep. And Fox just doesn't learn from rushing out their properties as they did with Alien 3, I guess.
Yeah, no, and there's a lot of interesting people who were offered this. Doesn't mean that they were attached, but they were offered. And Darren Aronofsky was offered, and he just finished filming The Fountain. Joss Whedon was offered this, but he was trying to get Wonder Woman made, and that obviously didn't happen.
Before DC and said, oh, you'll never direct a big superhero film.
Yeah, exactly. And then we also have Zack Snyder, who was approached to this, but he was already committed to 300, and I think he definitely made the right choice. And and then it came back to Brett Ratner, who was previously considered to direct X-Men in 1996, but turned it down, and then came back to him. And so it's had a troubled history, and I think it definitely suffered because it just didn't have one person's vision, or at least one cohesive vision by a group of people, like a movie usually does. And so it was just bouncing all over the place, and it definitely suffered. And I think I know this may sound small, and it's probably small to a lot of people, but one of the things that really hurt the film for me was the freaking class system that they developed, the classification.
Yeah, that was weird, because even though I didn't know the comic books, I thought it was weird that all of a sudden we're talking about mutant classes when that never was a thing in the previous two films.
It was right on the same level as introducing midichlorians into the Phantom Menace.
Was it really
Menace.
That bad? Now, you know the comic books more than me. There's never this talk of classes in the comics at all.
I never that I noticed. Now, I mean, there's so many different iterations between Silver Age, Gold Age, Prime Age, Platinum Age, Copper Age. I don't even know all the ages, but there's so many different iterations of Marvel Comics and DC Comics that I can't keep track of them all. All I can say from my personal experience is that I never once saw that.
I just remember thinking in the movie, well, this is odd. How come this wasn't a big deal in the last couple of films? But I was willing to go with it. Here's the thing. With 10 years of hindsight and having just rewatched X3 for this retrospective, I kind of see where they were coming from. And the premise, the X3 suffers from the fact that it's trying to tell two stories at the same time, two very disparate stories. But both of them are good. That's the thing. You have this idea of a mutant cure, and that presents a real moral dilemma for the X-Men, and that could be a great story in and of itself. On the other hand, you have this Phoenix story, which I know is altered from the comics because I hear that the Phoenix is actually this big space epic adventure.
Mm-hmm. It's an alien.
In reality, and I kind of think that, and as much as I'm going to get hate from the hardcore X-Men fans for this, I don't think you could do that with this series. I think it had to be altered the way it was altered.
I think you're right.
But that's a great story in itself. When you try to put them together, though, you're trying to do too many things at one time, and neither story is satisfied.
I think you're right, because both things are very cool. I think they did an okay job of integrating them, but they could have done a lot better. And the whole class thing, it's this corporate way to make things sound more badass than they actually are. And instead of just saying she's a mutant that's is more powerful than any other mutant that I've ever encountered, they have to give it a classification system like freaking tornadoes. Like, oh my god, this is a class 5
that's
tornado.
That's what I kept thinking of. It kept reminding me of Twister. Like the
yeah.
So essentially Jean Grey is an F5 mutant. No, she's a class 5 in the movie, but you know, F5.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. And like I said, it's this corporate cold way of saying, listen, folks, this is about to hit the fan. And that's what happened with the Phantom Menace. And it was just it was a horrible, horrible idea. And it just added to the absurdity.
And really, the other major mistake that they made, mistakes, plural, is, I really had some Alien 3 moments watching X3, in the sense that Scott, Professor X, and even Mystique, who's not dead, are taken out or devalued in the movie so quickly and without any fanfare at all, that it just feels like, oh, you don't know what you just threw away. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know what you just did.
Yeah, it was pretty sad and kind of and pretty weird that they took him out. So, like, just with Cyclops and Patrick Stewart and
Mystique's barely in the film. I mean, she's only at the beginning.
And she was so cool in 1 and 2, and then she was just—it was just another example of wasting people. But what's really funny is that to date, this is the highest-grossing X-Men film of all time.
Well, not to date anymore.
To date.
Well, are you talking about domestically?
Yes, I'm talking domestically.
You're talking domestically. If you're talking worldwide, Days of Future Past blew this out of the water.
Yes.
Domestically, I would agree. But I would argue there's a reason for that, because this came out, was a hit. I mean, it made its money back, but it many fans' reaction mirrored ours, where it's kind of like, oh no, this all fell apart and you had such a good buildup for it, and then the last film, what happened? And so, you know, when you do that in a film like this, where it's the third one in, the reputation becomes a bit damaged. And it certainly wasn't helped by X-Men Origins 3 years later. But so, you know, you have two films that really have damaged this this franchise's reputation, which was a trendsetter back in the early 2000s. So I think that even though this is the highest grossing X-Men to date, I think it speaks a lot on the merits of both First Class and Days of Future Past, that even though they didn't make as much, they're building back up, because Days of Future Past didn't beat this, but it came close. And I know you're adjusting for inflation, all that sort of stuff, but you know, you're having to remember that these last two films, X-Men films, not Wolverine films, X-Men films, are rebuilding the goodwill of the franchise. And I think they're doing a pretty good job of it.
I think so. Like, even like and like I said, I'm just talking domestically, and even when you don't adjust for inflation, it's still the highest grossing film domestically. But yeah, I think with what happened, like, X-Men Origins has to be the absolute worst X-Men film of all time, and yeah, I don't even want to talk about
it. It's the pits. I mean, X3 is a bad film, but I can watch it. I can't watch Origins Wolverine.
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like, I can't watch X-Men Origins, and the Wolverine I thought was just okay. And
if we're talking about Wolverine films, though, Wolverine 2013, big step up. I could sit down and watch that one.
Yeah, see, I just thought that was just okay. But it did not have a high bar to rise above with, you know, following X-Men Origins.
For me, it was good, but it was filler, because at that point, I know Days of Future Past is coming. That's the one I'm waiting for.
We were all just waiting for Days of Future Past. And also, I thought, see, that's the thing. It's like when you have, like, think about it this way, is that up until Days of Future Past, X2 was the last solid X-Men film that we had up until Days of Future Past.
I would kind of contest that a tiny bit. It's the last one that everybody universally embraced, but I don't know if we're going to talk about First Class on this podcast. I hope we do at some point, but I rewatched, I didn't know we were splitting this up, so I rewatched all of them.
Dude, we talked about splitting them up.
No, I don't remember this. And the whole reason we were waiting for, by the way, for the podcast for me to join is because I was finishing Days of Future Past.
Dude. Yeah, no, okay. No, what we're doing this podcast is the original trilogy, and like the next podcast or whichever that's going to be, we're going to talk about Days of Future Past with leading up with just a little bit of, we're going to talk about First Class. Than Days of Future Past.
Okay, well, what I'll say about First Class in this show, just to kind of preview my thoughts on that, is that I know it wasn't as universally loved, but I rewatched it in preparation for this show, thinking that we were going to do it. And you know what? I got to say, I remember where, you know, that it was summer of 2011. I go to see this in the theaters, and I was not blown away the way that I was with like X2, but you know what? I was charmed. I was so charmed by the fact that they were managed to kind of reboot the series in this sort of fun way. It was kind of like, okay, this is kind of, you know, it's not quite as good as X2, but we're getting back on track here after those last two films. We've course corrected a bit. I felt really good coming out of First Class and wanted to see more of that cast. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was like, I rewatched it as well, just because like my wife and I watched the original trilogy and then said, okay, well, let's watch First Class again, and I liked it more the second time I watched it because I only saw it one time before, and she didn't like it any more than she did the first time. And but yeah, no, I liked it more the second time. I still don't think it's a solid movie. I think it's an okay movie.
It's getting, you do have to agree, after, especially after Origins and even after X3, it's getting back on what the series should be.
Slowly getting back on track, but Days of Future Past solidified it.
Oh, sure, sure. But what I'm saying is you can't do it all in one film. You have to start moving it back.
They had four films, so...
Well, no, but you're talking about a damaged franchise. Up until those first two movies, it was not damaged. X3 damaged it, or Wolverine really damaged it. So you can't, you know, it's that old saying where, you know, if you do something wrong, it'll take, you know, 10 good things to cancel out that wrong thing.
Well, you still need to judge a movie on its own merits outside of what it's connected to.
You know what? I think won me over, and we're really kind of talking about First Class now, but I think First Class was crucial with its casting. And I really, really like these new actors playing the younger versions of the characters that I grew up with, because, you know, it was 2011, so it's 11 years later. So I think they did really well with the casting again, and I think that they really got a chance to shine in Days of Future Past.
I think so, too. But that'll have to wait until another podcast. But before we close out, Matt, give me your ranking of the first three.
The first three I definitely think is X2, closely followed on the heels by X1, and it's a long stone's throw before you hit X3, but still not as bad as Origins Wolverine.
There you go. I think I have the same. I kind of go back and forth between the first X-Men and X2, but I don't know. I just watched X2 not too long ago, and that's a pretty solid film. So I think your comments are echoed in mine. So thank you so much for listening. Please, if you like this podcast, tell your friends about it. We're trying to get more listeners. We're trying to get some more subscriptions. Tweet about us, Facebook about us, go to facebook.com/thenerdparty. Give us a like, give us a mention on Twitter. You can find me at The Insane Robin.
And you can find me at mhanson0207.
And please go to our website, thenerdparty.com. There you can find all the information that you would need to know about all of our previous podcasts and all the links that you could ever want. You can listen to us on literally any platform. We exist there. And if you would, if you like the show, give us a rating if you can. If you give us a 5-star rating, we'll give you a mention on the podcast. And a few people have done that.
Yes.
And we have some people to thank who gave us some glowing reviews, and we really do appreciate it. We have a Twitter user who is a favorite of mine, and that's LTL, Ray STL, Rachel Robeson. She is a big supporter of the show, and she's one of our biggest cheerleaders, and she's a fantastic person to talk to on Twitter. And so we thank you for giving us a review.
We also want to thank Paul Finch, who is another podcaster with me on the Trekmate Network. He's a very good friend of mine, and thank you, Paul, for listening and supporting this show, and we hope you continue to enjoy it.
And last but definitely not least, we have another 5-star review from Daniel_G. Thank you so much for what you guys said, and thank you so much for supporting the podcast. And a few of those were in the UK iTunes store, and they let us know on Twitter. So if you are outside of the US, please let us know by sending us an email at contact@thenerdparty.com or by notifying us on Twitter, because we can't always access that right away. So thank you so much for listening, and please tune in next week.
I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And we hope you join us again for the Nerd Party. And until then, stay mutant and proud.
Coming up next week.
We have a mission. Our mission does not work if the people on Earth are dead by the time we pull it off.
Well, we got this far, farther than any human in history.
Well, not far enough. make it count.
Where's the mountains?
Those aren't mountains. They're waves.
Am I gonna make it?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are.
You might have to decide between seeing your children again and the future of the human race.
We'll find a way. We always have.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.